sorry. That was it was a special short one play.
No, it was good timing for the short one too.
Yeah. It was lucky.
So, as you can see, we're going to do Galois cohomology, starting with basic group cohomology. But first we have to do some work with L-series and Galois representations attached to elliptic curves, which are in the notes that I handed out last time. If anybody doesn't have a copy of those notes, I have some extra copies here. So this is section 11.2 from last time.
Bringing this up because I want to show you some graphs in a moment that I had started to show you last time but ran out of time.
Right, so first what we'll do is we'll discuss section 11.2 somewhere. And here the goal is to tell you how to go from an elliptic curve defined over a number field, for example Q, but not necessarily Q, to a representation of the Galois group, this is E over K, to a representation of the Galois group of Q bar over K, and this will be a p-adic representation. So we'll take values in ZP, the p-adic, well, GL2 of ZP. It's a representation over ZP. And we'll construct this via a limit of representations mod P, P squared, P cubed, and so on. So this is the first thing. And once you have such an association, a way of going from an elliptic curve to a representation. Here you get one for each prime. Assuming certain properties about the representation, which are true for this one, you get an L function, L, E, S. It's an L function that doesn't depend on the trace of prime P. And this L function is a function which is a priori from some subset of the complex numbers to the complex numbers. In the case when the base field is Q, one knows that this function extends to an entire function, a holomorphic function on the entire complex plane. So that's the first thing. And the second thing will be to begin, well, I'll show you some pictures of L, E, S, the various elliptic curves, and also pictures of modular forms, S sub E, attached to various elliptic curves. Thank you.
Okay, so I wanted to kind of throw up the picture of that Ulster is really talk. Because that's pretty good. Okay, so that's an example graph of the L series of an elliptic curve. All right, so we'll do this. I'll tell you a little bit more about these pictures and how they're made. And three, we'll start group cohomology. And we probably won't get very far with this, and then we'll do more of this on Thursday. And we'll also do Galois cohomology, some discussion of some facts from Galois cohomology. Okay, so back to section 11.2. So the thing here is I'm going to explain to you how you can start with an elliptic curve over a number field and systematically associate to it a huge number of representations of this group, gal q bar over k. So again, as I mentioned much earlier in this course, or at least a few weeks ago, this group, gal q bar over q, which contains gal q bar over k, some people define number theory as the study of this group. And the way you study a group is you study representations of that group. So if you can think of a systematic way of associating a bunch of representations of a mysterious and interesting group to an object, then you're doing something right. And that's what we'll do with an elliptic curve over a number field. So here's a way to do that. So we'll first choose a prime number p. And consider a set of points on the elliptic curve. I'll call them capital P. I'll call them, I don't know, R. These are points on the elliptic curve with coordinates in Q bar with the property that they have order dividing P. So it's at first just a set of points on the elliptic curve. But it's a group, because if you have two points and p kills both of them, then the same is true of their sum, their difference, and you have inverses and so on. So this is a group, and it's denoted e square brackets p. This is a group. More generally, if you have any abelian group at all, then you can take the elements of order dividing p, or any number p, for any integer p actually, and you get a subgroup. So here's a group. So the first question is, what is its abstract structure just as a group, before you start worrying about how the Galois group acts on it? And there are various ways to think about this. So if you have an elliptic curve over a number field, its complex points are in bijection with the points in C modulo a lattice. So this is one of very many different ways to figure out what the abstract group structure of this is. So this comes from the Weierstrass P function. So if you to a lattice in the complex numbers, you can associate a function, a muromorphic function, as a function with just isolated poles that aren't essential singularities. You can associate a function to the lattice, and that function satisfies a differential equation, namely p prime squared is equal to, and then you have a cubic over here. It depends on how you normalize things, but think it's... this, there might be some normalization, but this is good enough. So this looks like an equation for an elliptic curve, and as you vary over various lattices, you get various equations for elliptic curves. And you can show that every, up to changing variables, every elliptic curve over a number field arises from some lattice. And the fact that the Weierstrass P function satisfies this really nice differential equation means that if you define a map from the complex numbers to the elliptic curve, where you view the elliptic curve as a set of solutions to, you know, y squared equals a cubic, then you get a map which is, let's see, so this is the points on the elliptic curve sitting inside of T2, and the map is z goes to the pair P of z, P prime of z. So this function, by the way, has poles, but the poles are exactly at the points in the lattice, and where it has a pole, you send it to infinity. So it's the infinity of P of z equals infinity. So infinity means the point O at infinity, the identity element of the group. So if it has a pole at z. So this map, it's from c to here, and it has kernel exactly lambda. Those are the points that go to the point. So it's really a map from C mod lambda, and it's an isomorphism. So you can view elliptic curves over number fields. If you take their complex points, it's the same as the complex numbers modulo a lattice. And another reason that you might think this is reasonable is that an elliptic curve is a genus one curve, which means that if you take its complex points, it's a torus. And now think about what the complex numbers modulo a lattice is topologically. So if you start with the complex numbers, and then you consider a lattice, for example, the lattice spanned by I and 1, and then you quotient out by this, the fundamental domain is this unit square, and you've made an identification. You've identified these opposite sides. So when you do that, you end up with a torus. So this is the reason I'm telling you all of this is just so that you'll have some sense for why this group, EP, is isomorphic to, as an abstract abelian group without its Galois structure, Z mod PZ squared. So this is just as an abstract group. So it's a direct sum of two copies of Z mod PZ. Okay, so why does that follow from the elliptic curve being C modulo a lattice? So there are two questions. One is, why are if I change this to C instead of Q bar, do I get anything different? That's one part of the question. And the other part of the question is, what is the group of points of order dividing P in C modulo a lattice? So there are two questions. So does anybody have any ideas about either of those two questions?
Could you say that one more time?
Sure. So just assume, don't worry about the Weierstrass P theory, which takes a while to develop and which I won't develop in here, but assume that you know that every elliptic curve over a number field, its complex points are isomorphic as a group to the complex numbers modulo a lattice. Can you deduce this statement right here? That's the question. And there are two points, so I'll get to you in a second. There are two points here. One is, why is E of Q bar, why are the elements of order dividing P in E of Q bar the same as the elements of order P in E of C? Why don't you get anything extra going from Q bar to C when you're looking at points of order dividing P? And the other question is, what is the group structure of C modulo a lattice? What are the elements of order P in C modulo a lattice? So Steve, do you have a remark?
I think for the first question, replacing Q bar by C, it wouldn't make a difference because if P times some point on the lattice, or P times some point on the elliptic curve over the complex numbers is infinity, then on that point, if you plug in the tangents and secants and whatnot, is going to satisfy some big polynomial
equation.
Right.
That's right.
so it's going to be in Q bar.
That's right. That's exactly right. If you, let's just do it. So that's all very complicated, but you can do it in one specific example that generalizes nicely and is exactly what you just said. So take P equals 2. What are the points of order 2 on an elliptic curve? So let's suppose our elliptic curve is y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b. Let's try to think about what the points of order 2 are and see why the, so here a and b are in a number field, let's see why the coordinates of the points of order 2 are actually algebraic integers. If you take the points of order 2 even over C, the actual coordinates are algebraic integers. The reason is, as Steve just said, the coordinates satisfy some huge polynomials, so they're algebraic integers. But let's see it very explicitly in the case of P equals 2. So what do we have to do? We have to think, okay, well, first let's draw a graph of the curve. That I think is very helpful as far as thinking about this problem goes. We have to think, what's the condition for a point on this curve to have the property that when you add it to yourself, you get the point in infinity?
Don't you need them to be on the vertical line?
Yeah, you just need them to be, so let's say it's like this, you just need them to, to have a, when you draw the tangent line, the other point of intersection has to be the point at infinity. So in this graph, there's the point right here that does that, point right here that does that, and this point that does that. And what are the x-coordinates of these points in terms of what I've written down already?
The roots of that equation of the right-hand side.
Yeah. So the y-coordinates are easy. They're all 0 because it's on the x-axis. The x-coordinates are exactly the roots of this equation, which are algebraic integers because a and b are algebraic integers and are algebraic numbers. So, I mean, all I need to do is assume that a and b are in some number field, and then the roots of this equation will also lie in some possibly bigger number field. And the y-coordinates here are all 0, so what you see from this is that E2, points of order 2, are, well, there's the points of order dividing 2, there's a point at infinity, which I'll call O, and then you have each of the x-coordinates being roots of this cubic polynomial. So here, I'm factoring the cubic as x minus alpha 1, x minus alpha 2, x minus alpha 3. Okay? And this generalizes to p equals 3, 4, 5, I mean, it doesn't have to be a prime, 5 and so on. In fact, if you want to see the, there's a command in Magma called division polynomial, and it returns a polynomial whose roots are exactly the x-coordinates of the points of order n for a given integer n. So let me show you how this works. I think there's an algorithm of Bayliu for doing this computation, which if anybody wants to do their project on putting this in Sage, that would be interesting. Okay, so let's take an elliptic curve, like, I'll do one of the form that's on the blackboard. So somebody choose an A and a B. Somebody choose an A.
4.
4? Okay, B?
Minus 11.
Okay, 4 minus 11. Okay, so there's our elliptic curve. And I think there's a command that's the division polynomial. Okay, I'm going to get the documentation for it. There it is. So division polynomial E comma 3. And it returns this polynomial here. To return some other things, but the first thing that it returns is a polynomial, and if you take the roots of this polynomial of degree 4, there are 4 of them, so you take the roots of that, those give you the x-coordinates of the 3 torsion points, and for each of those, you substitute them back into this cubic, and then you have 2 y-coordinates corresponding to each choice of sine when you take the square root. That gives you a total of how many points? Of order, so you get 4 roots from this.
Yeah, so you get 8 roots, order 3.
Yeah, so you get 4, and then you get, take the choices for y coordinates, and you get how many? Assuming the, so if you take each of these x coordinates, the zeros of this polynomial, and then substitute them back in, you end up with 8 different points because you have 2 choices of sine each time. And there are exactly 8 points of order 3. Plus there's one additional point that has order 1. So you end up with 9 total points in E3. Yes?
Never mind. I'm gonna see.
And this polynomial, by the way, I mean, you can get this pretty naively just by iterating the group law on a generic point. But that's not the most efficient way to do it. There are other tricks that are good, like, let's see. You're trying to find this, you're trying to solve 3p is equal to O. And you can write out explicitly for a completely generic point, p equals x comma y, what 3p is. You just add it to itself 3 times, and you get this big complicated formula. But you can also think of this as 2p plus p equals O. And that's the same as 2p equals minus p. And there's a very simple formula that takes p and gives you 2p. And minus p, that's just replacing y by minus y. So you end up with, by using various tricks like this, you can get simpler formulas, and you solve those, and you can get these division polynomials. And there's other ones, like, 8. They get complicated, of course, 13. But it can just compute them instantly, almost even for sort of large numbers. So they're really concrete things. They're just, given by taking all the roots of the polynomial and then adjoining a bunch of square roots corresponding and looking at each of those roots here and taking a square root. So they're concrete algebraic things. And again, they're just got by iterating the group operation a number of times and then setting the result equal to 0, and then you get a polynomial equal to 0, or more a rational function equal to 0. So. Okay, so we have, for each prime, or I didn't use anywhere that it's prime, so for each number n, so an integer, you have this, so on. The other question that I asked was, well, what is z mod lambda? What are the elements of order n, of order dividing n, say, inside of here? Why is this z mod nz squared? Any ideas? Yes, Elizabeth.
You can just take the lattice and then sort of divide it up into a lattice of order n. The point is, if you take one of the two generators of the lattice, then any divisor of, then divide by n, and then anything on that lattice is going to have order n.
Right.
Right.
So you're just saying, if you have something and it has order n, that means n times it is in the lattice. So it's in 1 over n times the lattice. And also you said that 1 over n times the lattice, everything there gives you something of order n. So this is exactly the same as 1 over n times the lattice, modulo the lattice. And that's just 1 over n z direct sum z, modulo z direct sum z, which is z mod n z direct sum z mod n z. So that works perfectly. So now we see why this has this structure. And now, the second thing to observe is that the Galois of q bar over k acts on en. So this Galois group acts on En. What that means is if you take an element of En, and you take an automorphism in the Galois group, and hit the x and y coordinates of that element, you get another element in En. Okay, so we could try to, you can think about doing that in this example. Here, E2, the Galois group, it's going to act by acting on the coordinates. That's the definition of how the Galois group acts. And the statement is that if you take one of these three points and hit it, that is, apply one element of the Galois group of q bar over k to it, you end up getting another one of these three points. And that's just because the roots of a polynomial are left invariant under the action of the Galois group. And this so this polynomial has coefficients in k, so its roots are left invariant as a set under the action of gal q bar over k. Because what you do is you plug in a root on the left hand side. If you think about this, if you plug in a root, you get this equal to 0, and then you apply the Galois group to both sides, and on the left hand side, you end up getting zero. You end up getting something equal zero, and that something, the a and the b have to be the same, so you get something which is a root of this polynomial equal to 0. So you see that one root goes to another root. Well, you probably are already noticed that the Galois group preserves the roots of a polynomial. That's basic Galois theory. Yes?
I'm wondering why... Oh, wait, so it's not true that all of the, say, x-coordinates of elements of EP have the same minimal polynomial.
That's right.
It's true that if
yeah, it could very
all
well
the
be,
roots of the
yeah.
minimal polynomial of any one in there are.
Yeah,
such.
Exactly.
That's
it right. could very well be that these are all elements of K, and then the action is trivial. Or it could be that you have a quadratic factor and a linear factor, and then this one gets fixed, but these two get switched back and forth.
Or
and
it's
and
possible that you'll have more than one minimal polynomial?
Well, in that case, you'd have a linear minimal polynomial and a quadratic minimal polynomial.
No,
or
I guess
I understand what you mean.
In the set EP, there'll be you know, the complete set of roots for some minimal polynomial and then
mm-hmm.
for another as well. Is that possible? For example, it seems to me that if the y-coordinates were...
One thing is, I'm only talking about this polynomial specifically in the case of 2. For 3 or higher, we'll need a slightly different argument.
Okay, that's
okay?
fine.
Yeah.
fine
yeah. Because you have to take all these square roots with the y's, and maybe that messes everything up. And I mean, you could directly argue like this, but really the thing to do is to note that if you consider multiplication by n as a map from the elliptic curve to itself, then this is, if you consider what it actually does to points, this map is a map of Gal Q bar over K modules. So E of Q bar, that's certainly preserved under the action of Gal Q bar over K. If you have a solution to the elliptic curve equation and you change the x and y coordinates by an automorphism, a single automorphism, you get another solution, just because the equation that defines the elliptic curve has coefficients in K. So the important thing is that multiplication by n preserves the Galois, that this is a homomorphism of Galois modules. So to see that, what you need is that, the assertion is that if you have any element of the Galois group of Q bar over K, and you consider sigma brackets np, so this is n times p. I guess I don't really need to write the brackets there. Sigma n times p, this should be the same as n times sigma of p. And this is because if you write down a formula for multiplication by n, which is just multiplication by n is take a, and you can get it by iterating p or p, you know, you can iterate the group law over and over again to get multiplication by n. And the group law is given by formulas, as I saw in the last lecture, I wrote them down explicitly, in the notes at least. There are formulas that have all their coefficients in K. So multiplication by n, it's given by some formula, and that formula has all its coefficients in K. So if you have a point that goes to 0 here, then when you hit it by the Galois group, it will also go to 0 here, because this is a module homomorphism. And the reason, again, it all sort of is the same thing, but the reason, again, is because when you write down explicitly a formula for addition of a point with itself n times, the formula that you write down has two rational functions, and those rational functions have coefficients in K, and K is fixed by the Galois group. So this this group En, which is isomorphic to Z mod nZ cross Z mod nZ, it's a module for the Galois group. So for example, you get a homomorphism from the Galois group to the automorphisms of E, let's say P to the N, for each or fixed prime p and each positive integer n. And if you fix a basis for e p to the n, do this in a compatible way for each power of n, then you can identify this with GL2 of Z mod T to the NZ. So you get a homomorphism from the Galois group of Q bar over K to GL2 of Z mod P to the NZ. And then you take all these homomorphisms together, and you get a homomorphism from Gal Q bar over K to GL2 ZP. So let's see, what, if anything, was clear there? Do you have any questions? So you fix a prime P, you get a mod P Galois representation, which would just be when n equals 1.
It's a homomorphism from the Galois group to ought EP, which is just, you know, it's a two-dimensional FP vector space, so that's GL2FP.
And then you combine all these together as n goes to infinity, and you get a representation to ZP, a p-adic Galois representation. So it's a little different than what we talked about previously in the context of Arden's conjecture, where we talked about representations to GL2 of C. Here it's, you have GL2 of a finite field or GL2 of ZP. Part of the motivation for considering this is to associate L functions to elliptic curves in a natural way. There's no really good way to associate a representation into GL2 of C to an elliptic curve. It just doesn't have the right properties. You could take this representation to GL2 of FP and then try to map GL2 of FP into GL2 of C, but you won't get very far in doing that. Has anybody here taken a representation theory course? You have? Right,
250.
They talk at all about trying. Two-dimensional complex representations of GL2 of FP. Any comments by anyone who may have taken 250? It's just not a good thing to consider. You can't do this for P very large, that's all I'll say. But in any case, what you can do is you can map to GL2 of ZP, and that does sort of remind you of GL2 of C, because ZP embeds into QP, which embeds into CP. So at least this sits inside of GL2 of CP, which is the p-adic analog of the complex numbers. Though this is infinite, but each of these representations, the finite GL2s have finite image, so if you put the right topology on this, you get a nice continuous representation here. So we won't worry about that too much. So let me tell you how to attach an L function to this representation. And it won't depend on the choice of prime P, though that's a non-trivial fact. So the actual way of doing this is very similar to what we did before. It'll all seem extremely familiar. So here's what you do. Take a prime L, and I want to associate a characteristic polynomial to it. So what I do is I make any trace of prob L, and this is really, it's really only defined up to conjugation, and it's an element of the Galois group of, well, one problem is that this image is not finite, so really, let's just view this as an element of Galois Q bar over K. So there are two ways for you to think about this, this choice of an element. So here you could think about this, one way would be to think about Z bar and choose a prime of Z bar lying over L. Here L is a prime of OK. You could choose a prime of Z bar lying over L, and then the decomposition group is the subgroup of the Galois group of Q bar
over k that sends that prime to itself, that fixes that prime. And then inside of the decomposition group, you have the same sort of setup as before. You have an inertia group and a residue class field, and you can choose a frob, which is well-defined up to the inertia group. But if you don't like that at all, simply make the definition, except replace Q bar by the fixed field of the kernel of one of these homomorphisms. You'll get what I'm doing now, you'll get a characteristic polynomial mod p to the n for each p to the n. You take those all together and you get a characteristic polynomial with coefficients in zp. So actually, I'll do exactly that since it's maybe more concrete. So you have a prime of ok, you have an integer n, and we'll just take the Galois group of q e p to the n over k. Oh, that should be k. P to the n over k. So this is a finite extension of k. It's the extension got by adjoining all the coordinates of the p to the n torsion points on the elliptic curve to k. So over here, k e2, is exactly k adjoined alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3. Is it a Galois extension?
Yeah.
Yes.
Why? Because it's a splitting field. In this case, it's clearly that. And it's true in general that it's a Galois extension. Because, why? Why is it true in general?
Because the points of order p to the n are the roots of some polynomial, and
mm-hmm.
so we're just looking at the splitting field of that polynomial.
Exactly. And another kind of double check is that this argument I had, this is circular, of course, but I argued that the Galois group preserves, that you get an action of the Galois group on ep to the n. So if you have a pair of points, a point given by a pair x, y, then its image under the Galois group is also a point. That means that the x-coordinate, if you take its image under an automorphism, gives you another x-coordinate. So when you adjoin all the x-coordinates, those are that set of things is closed under the Galois group. So this is a Galois extension, and same with the y-coordinates. But your argument's better because I used what you said in order to prove that this was preserved under the Galois group. Okay, so choose a Frobenius element in there, and that's something that I told you exactly how to do. We talked about that in detail. And what this means is you take some prime lying over L in the ring of integers of this field, and then you take the Frobenius element for that. And this is well-defined up to conjugation. That's why I put it in square brackets. It's a class well-defined up to conjugation. And you have a two-dimensional z mod p to the nz module, which is the points of order p to the n, and you have an action of this thing on it, so you get a characteristic polynomial. But this is not well-defined. Not well defined. So this is well defined. I think I just said it was well defined to conjugation, but that's not true. It's well defined to conjugation and the inertia group. If the problem were just conjugation, then this Carapoli would be well defined and we'd be done. But it's conjugation and the Galois group. I mean, and the inertia group. So this is the inertia. So you have to worry about that. So instead of taking the Carapoli of Frobel and the whole thing, as before, you take Carapoli of Frobel on the inertia invariance. And that is well-defined, and you get a well-defined polynomial in here. Now, if you do this for sufficiently large n, you'll notice that the polynomials you get somehow it stabilizes. This is a theorem. This polynomial will stabilize after a while. That is to say, all of these polynomials are actually the reduction of a single polynomial with coefficients in z. So it's a non-trivial statement, and I unfortunately don't think I won't be able to prove that in here. But fact, so
these polynomials are all the reduction of a polynomial for a given L. All the reductions of a polynomial R sub L, no, actually P sub L of X in Z adjoint X. In particular, the polynomial doesn't depend on the power of n. And after a while, you just get the same thing over and over again. If you choose L to be coprime to, well, if it's unramified, so you don't have to, so there's no inertia group. And it will be unramified for all primes of good reduction for the elliptic curve and not dividing P. So there's some finite number of primes outside of which this, well, this, no matter how you choose the n, it will be unramified, then this polynomial doesn't even, see what I want to say. It doesn't depend on the choice of p. So as it is now, I've chosen a prime p, I've constructed the representation using that prime, I'm making characteristic polynomials, again, acting on the p torsion. But the amazing thing is, as long as your L is not equal to P, actually, this polynomial doesn't even depend on the choice of P. It's just some polynomial with integer coefficients, doesn't depend on P, doesn't depend on N, etc. So no matter how you choose the P and how you choose the N, as long as L isn't equal to P, you get this process eventually stabilizes. And the reason for this is that there's an alternative interpretation for the polynomial, and I'll tell you what it is. So if L is a prime with good reduction, so if L is unramified, or if L is a prime of good reduction, and L is not equal to P, then this is the special case of K equals Q, but there's something that's true more generally, then in fact this polynomial is just x squared minus ALX plus L, where AL is from last time, it's L plus 1 minus the number of points on the reduction of the curve over the finite field FL. So that's why it's independent, that's why it's really a polynomial in Z, it's because you can identify what this recipe gives you, and you find that it is something that has coefficients in Z. And there's something analogous to this at the bad primes, except there you have either a linear or a constant polynomial, but I won't get into that. So, given an elliptic curve, there's a way to associate to it a whole bunch of representations of the Galois group of Q bar over K. If you take one of these representations, and then consider the characteristic polynomial Frobenius acting on the inertia invariance, which for all but finitely many primes is just the whole thing acting on the inertia invariance, or just the whole thing, the points of the elliptic curve, you get a polynomial. This collection of polynomials for a fixed L doesn't really depend on the choice of P and N, as long as P isn't equal to L. So you get a whole bunch of polynomials. Those polynomials, at least in the case of Q, just happen to be these. And now, whenever you have a systematic way of associating to something a bunch of polynomials, you can write down an L function. And here's the L function in this case. L E S is the product over all primes L of R sub L of L to the minus S, where here, it's 1 over that. I'd rather write it. 1 over R sub L, L to the minus S. And here R sub L is just the reversed version of P sub L of X. So in the case of Q, and L of good prime, this become, well, R sub L of L to the minus S is 1 minus AL L to the minus S plus L equal to the minus s times. L to the minus 2s times L. So L to the 1 minus 2s. Actually, I'll keep it this way. L times L to the minus 2s. So that's the L function of the elliptic curve. And over Q, it's just given explicitly in terms of these A sub L's. By the way, if you multiply this all out, you get something that, you end up getting a Dirichlet series. So in the case of Q, that's, I'm really specializing to the case of Q here, since what do I mean by L? I think I have to replace this by norm of L when L is a prime of OK. But if you take this L function of E for E over Q, and that's this product, 1 over 1 minus AL L to the minus S plus L times L to the minus 2S, and there are, these are the good primes, so product over L good, and then there are some other factors for L bad. If you multiply this out, you end up getting a Dirichlet series, sum AN over N to the S, N equals 1 to infinity. So here, the A sub N, they're, for the purposes of this equality, they're just defined by what you get when you multiply this out and look at the coefficient of N to the minus S. But they're exactly the same as the A sub N I defined by what seemed to be a somewhat ad hoc definition last time. So for example, A sub P times Q, or P and Q are coprime, is A sub P times A sub Q, and so on. So this is all you need to know. The funny looking definition of the A sub N in general for N composite just comes from this product when you multiply it out. Okay, so that's the L function of an elliptic curve, and here's a picture of an L function of an elliptic curve. This is for an elliptic curve of rank 1. That means its order of vanishing at the point s equal to 1 is 1. The Burchin-Swearington-Dyer conjecture, which I mentioned in the slides I went through, is that the order of vanishing of this function at s equal to 1 should equal the rank of the elliptic curve. This is a graph in the following sense. What I've done is I've taken, well, here's just the absolute value of the real part of the L function. This is a subset of the complex numbers going from 1 half to 1 plus 1 half. And here this is the imaginary axis, I guess over here, going from 1 half to 1 half plus 1, plus a little bit less, I guess plus 1 half I. So this is 1 half plus 1 half I. And right here in the middle where it's really dark, that means it's really small. And right here, this is where you have a 0 at s equal to 1. So this is the point 0, this is the point 1 in the complex plane. And at that point, you can see that the real part is 0 because it's black there. You should think of this graph as follows. It's the colors red means hot, blue means cold. So low is blue or black. The lower it is, the blacker it is, the bluer it is, and the higher it is, the redder it is. So it's sort of low in the middle, and then. And I think if we go back, we can see the imaginary part. Yeah, so this is exactly the same function, but I graphed the imaginary part. And where the real and imaginary parts are both simultaneously zero, that's where the function is actually zero. So if you think about the intersection of the black parts of these two graphs, that gives you where this function actually vanishes. And you can see it's just at the point s equal to 1 in this case. This little part of the complex numbers. By the way, if you take this L function, LES, there's a Riemann hypothesis for this L function. So there is a 0 at s equal to 1 in this particular example. There's a critical strip. For an elliptic curve, the critical strip is between 0 and 2, at least the way that I've normalized it here. And the Riemann hypothesis for the L function of an elliptic curve is that all the non-trivial zeros should lie on the line real part of s equal to 1. Not real part of s equal to 1 half, but real part of s equal to 1. Okay?
Is this open?
Yes, this is very much an open form. It's much harder than the usual Riemann hypothesis. Let me show you something, which is a list of the first few non-trivial zeros for this particular function. I just happen to have it here. So if you take the L function attached to the first elliptic curve of rank 1, namely 37a, namely the one that I used as the example in the talk, notes in the slide notes, y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x. For this particular curve, which is called 37a, the first non-trivial zero of the L function of that curve is out to the point 1 plus 5.03170014i. So, draw a graph. It has a simple 0 at s equal to 1, but then if you go up the imaginary, if you go up into the upper half plane, you find another 0 at, I guess, way up here at 1 plus I times 5.00317... Okay? And in terms of these graphs, so this is a picture similar to the one I showed you before, and this is locally around the point 1 plus 5i, and you can see it really does look like there's a zero there. Okay. And if we go back to the email, let me look at that for a second longer. So sorry, there's a zero right there. And there's lots of non-trivial zeros, and the conjecture is that they should all lie in the line s equal to 1. There's really, really a lot of them. So back to the email, so the list goes on, you can see more and more. And if you look up, there's a webpage by somebody named Michael Rubenstein, who is a student at Princeton of Peter Sarnak, and he does thesis on various problems related to zeros of L functions attached to elliptic curves and other things. And he's computed, you know, tons and tons of these zeros of L functions of elliptic curves at non-trivial points. Okay, so is there anything else to tell you about
all functions of elliptic curves? Okay, so I think that's... I'll just tell you the main conjectures now.
So one conjecture is that if you take an elliptic curve over a number field, then the L function should extend to an L function on the whole complex plane, which I've already mentioned a few times. So the L function should extend to an L function on the whole complex plane. This is a theorem over Q. So if you take an elliptic curve defined over Q, then it is known that its L function extends to the whole complex plane. And this follows from the modularity theorem of Wiles and other people, Bray, Conrad, Diamond, and Taylor. And the reason is because if you, well, I'm not telling you how they prove it, but I'm going to tell you something about what's involved, or what the structure of the ideas are. So suppose you have an elliptic curve over Q, then we know by this theorem I quoted, the modularity theorem, that it is attached to or related to a modular form, f of Q, or f of, f of z equals sum n equals 1 to infinity, a sub n, e to the 2 pi I z n. Here the a sub n are either the coefficients when you multiply everything out over here, or they're given by the recipe from last time. It's exactly the same thing. So this amazingly is a modular form, which means that if you draw a picture of it, it has lots of nice symmetries. And more precisely, f of z, if you think of this as a differential, this is fixed under the action of a subgroup of the group of linear fractional transformations. A specific subgroup. So this is said to itself under the action of any linear fractional transformation.
So you have that fact. Then there's a general construction due to, well, it's really studied by Hecta, which associates an L function to a modular form. And we just associated an L function to an elliptic curve. And this L function is some an over n to the s. And this L function is, if you multiply it out, and well, it's some an over n to the s. So they're the same, except here, the nice thing is that it's not really too hard to prove using the properties of a modular form, all these extra symmetries that a modular form has, that this is entire. You can analytically continue this very easily, actually, just using this using the properties. There's a nice proof of this in Knapp's book on elliptic curves. So that this is entire, it's pretty easy, actually. It's entire. See Knapp's book. Knapp and elliptic curves. But they're the same, so this L function must also be entire, since it happens to agree with the L function of a modular form, and L functions of modular forms, from the amazing symmetry that modular forms have, can easily be seen to be entire. So that's just the structure of how you get holomorphicity of this function from the fact that elliptic curves are related to modular forms. Okay, now I'm just going to show you a few graphs of modular forms and L functions. The graphs of modular forms, like this one right here, are very easy to make in the sense that there's not really that much deep mathematics that goes into making this graph. Here's all I did to make this graph. I took a specific elliptic curve, and the specific elliptic curve is this one right here. Here's the equation. So y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x squared minus 10x minus 20. It's the curve with smallest conductor. It's somehow one of the simplest curves. It's actually the curve x naught of 11, when I mentioned modular curves before. And I computed, I think, 500 of the a sub n's. So I computed the first 500 of these, just using pair b. And then I just substituted in to this formula many complex numbers in some grid, and then graphed the result. So there's nothing really particularly sophisticated here. And I didn't do any careful analysis of the convergence, but you'll notice that it starts at point 1 in this particular picture. If you try 1,000 terms instead of 500 terms, you find that you get almost the same number when you when you're sufficiently far away from the x-axis. And this is way more than enough as far as being sufficiently far away is. So if you were to take just some random series, you wouldn't see some nice symmetry like this, but here you do see some symmetry. Although you don't really see much in this picture, but you'll see more in some later pictures. So the first one was the absolute value of what you get when you sum that up, and that's how it's colored. The second one is the argument. So at each point you have a complex number, which is, again, you're summing the first 500 terms of the series at a particular complex number. You get a complex number out. You take that complex number. In this graph, what I do is I computed its argument, and then I graphed the argument, where red means a large number and blue means a small number. And argument isn't such a good function. It's not continuous. You know, you start out here, and it's 0, and then you go around to 2 pi, and then suddenly you're 0 again. So it's, you know, it's not such a nice function. That's why you see these discontinuities. But still, there's some sort of surprising symmetry in here, right down at the bottom. This is the absolute value of the real part of the modular form. So instead of taking just the absolute value of that number when you sum it up, or the argument of that number, I took the absolute value of the real part of the number. And that's what you get. And here's the absolute value of the imaginary part. So together, these two determine the function up to sine, up to sine of the real and imaginary part. But you can hopefully see some extra symmetry in here where you have that sort of thing. You can kind of reflect this around like that. Okay, here's the L function of the elliptic curve we've been talking about. And it's actually pretty boring. For example, it does not have a 0 at s equal to 1.
It's non-zero at that point, right here. So if you got high enough, you'd find some zeros. This is the real part of the L function, the imaginary part. Notice that it's real valued along the real axis. That's why it's black along the real axis. If you graph the imaginary part of a real valued function, it's just zero. So that's why it's black there. For 37a, here's the modular form. So this picture looks very similar to the last one. This is the modular form, but what I've done is I've just bravely, instead of cutting off at point one, I've gone down a little bit farther. At the very bottom, probably that's just noise, because the series doesn't converge very well. But if you go up a little bit and just look, it really does converge reasonably well, say, from here up. And you can see even more symmetry. So you should sort of think about this. It's like that these symmetries would be like, you know, sort of usual symmetries in the hyperbolic plane, but they're kind of funny symmetries here. But so you see lots of extra symmetry that you wouldn't see at all if you just graph some random polynomial. Here's another graph. It's the real part of the modular form for 37a. One symmetry, which is easy to see, is a function of e to the 2 pi I z. So its invariant under z goes to z plus 1. So notice that, in fact, if you translate this over by 1, you get the same picture. Just because, right, again, if you replace z by z plus 1, it's e to the 2 pi I, you know, z plus 1. So you're just multiplying by 1. And this is the absolute value of the imaginary part. This is a grayscale version of what I just showed you before. So black is small and white is high. This is the L series. I showed you this earlier in this lecture. So where the two black regions intersect is the zero at S. Okay, now let's look at a curve of rank 2. The modular form, it's the same picture again. This is another one where I've drawn the graph, but I've gone closer to zero, and you can see lots and lots of symmetry here. So this is what a modular form looks like. It's a function that has a huge amount of symmetry, and you can really see it. This is the absolute value of the real part of the modular form, the absolute value of the imaginary part of the modular form. This is the L series. The absolute value of the real part of the L series at S equal to 1. This is an L series that vanishes to order 2 at S equal to 1. And you can see that the locus of the real part looks like two curves meeting. So if you think about suppose you have some function, let's just do it at 0 instead. F of z equals, say it vanishes to order 2, so z squared plus higher order terms, well, some constant times z squared plus higher order terms. And let's suppose you truncated the series right there, z squared, and then graphed it. Let's suppose you graphed the real part. Then, so z is x plus I, y, then you have a constant times, I'll forget about the constant, that doesn't really affect the picture. So you have x plus I, y, quantity squared. And now let's say you graph the real part of this equal to zero. That would be, well, just multiplying, I have x squared plus 2ixy minus y squared. And the real part of this is x squared minus y squared, x minus y times x plus y. So the zero locus of the function that vanishes at order 2 should look something like, you know, two lines coming together. And that's exactly what the picture is like. So, and now if you graph the imaginary part, there it is. And again, you see the zero locus, that's like this black locus here. And where those two intersect, that's where the function really is zero. And the intersection of these two, one x is sideways, the other x is straight up and down, the intersection is just at 0, and it's a 0 at s equal to 1 of order 2 in this particular case. Okay, the next example is an elliptic curve of rank 3. Now, it's a very deep theorem that the order vanishing of this L function at s equal to 1 is exactly 3. And this was proved by Grissom's. So here's the modular form. The modular form, again, doesn't really look that much different. That's kind of fun. This is a very zoomed in graph of the argument of the modular form close to zero. So you see some extra symmetry there. This is just a very zoomed in view. Now here's the last picture I'll show you. This is the absolute value of the real part of this L function that is supposed to vanish to order 3. So if I turn off more lights, you can see this better. all I can do. So, here, it looks like there are six things coming together, right? And that's consistent with the order of vanishing being three, but it just looks like there are six different sort of dark regions coming together. Just like if you were to take z cubed and then graph real part of z cubed equal to zero, you would have some algebraic curve of order three. It would, you know, factor, and you would have three different curves. So you have somehow a curve like that, and a curve like that, and a curve like that, and they're all coming together. But the fact that there are, in this picture, that there are really three different curves, or six different lines there, that's a really deep theorem. For all we know, before proving the Gross-Zagier theorem, for all we know, there's really only four there. It just looks like six when you draw the graph to the precision that you can draw it. It's kind of funny. Okay, so that's it with the graphs, I think. Okay, any questions about this?
Not about the picture itself so much as the curves associated to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there a canonical way to say, like, this is curve 5077A?
Yes. Yeah. Cremona invented a way of doing this, which is bizarre and somewhat complicated, but let's see what I want to tell you. So first, so if you have an elliptic curve, there's something called the conductor of the elliptic curve, which I've mentioned a few times. I'm not going to define this. I'll tell you a little bit about it. If p is it's an integer, a positive integer divisible by exactly the primes of bad reduction for the curve. If p is greater than or equal to 5, then p exactly divides n, if and only if you have multiplicative reduction at p, which means that when you reduce it, you get a node. And p squared divides it exactly, if and only if you have additive reduction. This is only for p greater than or equal to 5. So this completely determines, in a simple way, the conductor for p greater than or equal to 5. For p equals 2 and 3, it's more complicated. The power for 2, the power can be up to 2 to the 8th, and for 3, it can be up to 3 to the 5th. So you have all these various possibilities. So, but in any case, there's a number called the conductor associated to the elliptic curve. Another definition, it's the biggest n, so that this function is invariant under gamma 0 of n. I guess it's also it can also be defined as a conductor in the sense of there's a general notion of conductor for representations, and you can get that from these Galois representations. So the labeling, though, is the following. If you have an elliptic curve, you label it by giving a number, which is the conductor, and then a letter here. And the letter, well, it's a little bit complicated, but basically you put an ordering on, essentially put an ordering on the modular forms corresponding to the elliptic curves. And the first letter is A, the second curve in that ordering is B, the third curve is C, and so on, up through Z, and then the next one is AA, the next one after that is BB, at least, silly, it's not base 26, it's just AA, BB, all the way up through ZZ, and then AAA, BBB, CCC. So it gets really long really quickly if you try to do this for a large number. But the actual ordering is complicated. I'll just sort of say it, not expecting you to understand too much of what I'm about to say. But there are involutions on the space of modular forms, and there are certain involutions called the Atkin-Lehner involutions, and you have one for each prime power that exactly divides n. And they act on your modular form as plus 1 or minus 1. So you take the sequence of signs of the Atkin-Lehner involutions in the modular form. You order your curves first by those sequences of signs so that everything with the same Atkin-Lehner involution is next to it, everything else. And then after you do that, you order by the absolute values of the coefficients a sub 2, a sub 3, a sub 5, a sub 7, and so on. We only take the ones whose subscript is coprime to the level. So it's bizarrely complicated ordering. I don't like it, but that's what it is. There's a table of Cremona, so usually you don't have to, you know, figure out what the label is for a curve. And actually, it's I think, a very difficult computational problem to figure out what the labeling is for a specific curve. If you just choose a random curve, it might take you years to actually figure out what the labeling would be. But for curves of small conductor, there is a table of, oh, I'm not online. There's a table of every curve of conductor up to 30,000. So that's kind of the current state of the art. Cremona has enumerated every single curve for which the conductor is any integer up to 30,000. And if I'm online in a second, I'll show you his tables, which are available online. But you can get them to them from my webpage by saying modularfastharvdu/Cremona. It isn't connecting to the Wi-Fi network, so I can't show you the online version. But it's just /Cremona. And I have his tables locally on my laptop, and I'll see some of them. Okay, so here are what his tables look like. And if you go down the ways he describes what's in the tables, and then the data. This says 20,000, that's because this is an old version of the file that describes the tables on my laptop. What he gives is the conductor, then he gives the labeling, which is that letter that I described, and then he gives some, the equation for the curve, and additional arithmetic invariants, such as the rank of the curve, the order of the torsion of the curve, and so on. So we can look at an example file. Here's one. So there's an example file, and you can see here 11A1, and there's the equation for the curve right there. And then 11A2, 11A3, and so on. I neglected, there's one additional number, which is after the letter. All the curves with a given number and letter are isogenous. That is, there's a morphism of finite degree from one to the other, homomorphism of finite degree. The size of an isogeny class is finite. There are only finitely many curves in a given isogeny class. If you look at data, it's always at most 8. Everyone tells me it should be straightforward to prove that there are at most 8 curves in an isogeny class, but I don't think it's written down anywhere in the literature. That'd be a good project for somebody, by the way, but possibly outside of the scope. So in any case, here's an example where you have 6 different curves. They're all isogenous. That is, they're maps. They're homomorphisms of finite degree from one to the other. So we can go up to this 37 example I keep showing you, 37A, here it is. There's the equation. And 37B, that's another curve of the same conductor. It has rank 0, as you can see, from the second to the last column. And this table just keeps going and going and going. So here are all the elliptic curves of each conductor. These are the elliptic curves over Q.
So when you list one without the last number, like 37A, is that just because there's only one in the isogeny?
The default for omitting the last number is 1. And there is an ordering on the curves in an isogeny class. And when it says 1, it's getting more and more technical, but when it says 1, that means that, let's see. This is a little bit difficult to define, but so if you write 37A, that means the same thing as 37A1. And every elliptic curve is a quotient of x0 of n. The one with the 1 after it is the one that's closest to x naught of n, in the sense that you can't factor through any intermediate elliptic curve in a non-trivial way. So that's what's meant when you say
so it was just coincidence that 37A happened to be a
yes,
in this class.
That's right. But if you look at data or heuristics, then the expectation is the probability that a curve has any isogenies is 0. So if you look at huge numbers of curves, the average size of an isogeny class is 1. Usually curves don't have any extra curves isogenous to them. Though if you look at the data in this table, you often see numbers in the third column that are not 1, which seems to contrast with what I just said. But that's because these are small numbers. If you look at curves of much larger conductor, then you'll typically see 1 in the last column. Okay, so any other questions about elliptic curves? We seem to be getting near to the end.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, so the next thing is group cohomology and Galois cohomology. So I want to do a little survey, if I can find my notes for cohomology. I don't have any of my notes. There's a bunch back there, actually. So who here has seen anything about group cohomology? Wait, raise your hands higher.
Seen or like cohomology?
Seen or know what we're doing?
No, seen is the first thing. Like cohomology in a general sense, or is this just
group? Just group cohomology. Not cohomology in algebraic topology, but actual cohomology of groups, which is, you know, you could easily have taken a homologic algebra course and a topology course and never seen group cohomology in particular. Okay, so about half of you. Good. Okay, and then what about understood group cohomology? Okay, that's interesting. What about Galois cohomology?
Parts that are more complicated than parts that are more obvious, so it was a topic in 250, so
you can also crunch out the algebra and still not know what you're doing.
That's for sure. I think that you'll never know what, you never really know what cohomology groups are. You just work with them and use formal properties. But I mean, cohomology groups are basically groups that are defined by, so they're characterized by certain properties. Namely, you have a long exact sequence, and they vanish on certain objects in your category. And they have a certain property for H0. And these three properties uniquely determine the cohomology groups in whatever setting you're considering. And basically, you use those properties, and you chase a bunch of diagrams, and you can deduce, and must be able to, in fact, deduce anything about cohomology groups. So that's why you often feel like you're just formally working with them but not really understanding them. It's because I think they're just determined by having various properties, and you prove a theorem that they're uniquely determined by this. But to actually work with them, it must be possible to deduce anything about them just by using their formal properties. So you often end up doing that. Okay, so let me just give you an outline of what we're going to do. I'm just going to kind of walk you through this. By the way, make sure you get a copy of the homework assignment, which I handed out, in case you haven't. It's not attached to the notes. It's a separate sheet of paper.
Are we supposed to give the first problem to Andre and then the proposal to you?
That's a good idea. Yeah. Though if you wrote both on one piece of paper, don't worry. Because Andre will give them to me at some point. Okay. But yeah, that would be a good idea. This will be it should be an easy problem set. The one from last week. Okay, so first what I'll do is I'll talk about what a module is over a group. And then in theorem 12.2.1, I give three properties of group cohomology. And it's a theorem that does completely determine group cohomology. So you could view that as the definition of group cohomology, and the amazing fact is that group cohomology actually exists. I won't do it that way. I'll define H0 and H1, and then I'll give this theorem, which tells you what properties completely determine group cohomology. And then, I won't prove that the higher cohomology groups exist, but they do exist. But you should think of group cohomology again as it's the groups that are determined by theorem 12.2.1, by the conditions of theorem 12.2.1. Plus H0 and H1 are given very explicitly. Then I'll just show you how you can apply the theorem to just follow your nose in kind of a random way and to do something really interesting just by accident about H2. Then I'll state the inflation, tell you what the inflation restriction maps are, and prove the inflation restriction exact sequence, which is really useful if you're doing, anything in cohomology. So I'll give a complete proof of that. And then I'll do Galois cohomology. So I'll define Galois cohomology, and in terms of Galois cohomology, I'll describe Kummer theory for number fields, which is pretty easy. This is a description of the abelian extensions of a bounded exponent of a number field that contains the nth roots of unity. So if you want to know what the degree n extensions, cyclic degree n extensions are of a number field that contains the nth roots of unity, it's described by Kummer theory. For example, when n equals 2, you take the rational numbers, what are the quadratic extensions of the rational numbers? That's an example. What are the cubic extensions of q adjoin zeta 3? Kummer theory describes that. Then there's something very similar, which is Kummer theory for elliptic curves, and from that, if you think about it carefully enough, you get the weak Mordell-Day theorem. Well, you have to use some very non-trivial results. Okay, so it's exactly 11:30. I'll see you on Thursday. And on Thursday, the first thing we'll do is just start with group cohomology.
Oh, by the way, so there is section today. I just forgot to read that was good.
Also, so everyone knows, there's free Ben and Jerry's today.
Yes. Oh yeah, that's right. <works. laughs>
We're gonna get copies of them because the Inces came over looking for copies too, and they were just like, what? The Inces, and I was just like, alright, well, why don't you make two copies? I would do that best there without me there.
Is there a way to control what type of paper you get?
Do you remember that we were trying to induction from LPK of V to local induction?
Yeah.
The proof we came up with was wrong.
That's the one like I didn't
want. So I had to come up with something ridiculously complicated compared to what we were thinking.
Oh no.
But anyway, it worked out.
Door on Z.
Thanks.
But anyway,
he'll be happier.
And thanks for the answers.
You have a question?
Good question.
Yeah.
Did you appears that the book about psychochemical extensions, the Washington's book, is checked out and like,
I have it.
Like, can I borrow your copy?
Sure.
Or
you
Thursday?
Yeah.
Come
to
my office right now. If you have time right now, yes. Okay. Yeah.
You have office hours today.
That's right. 3 to 4, and also Thursday.
What floor is that?
5. Yeah, 5-5. It's right by the staircase. Like, just go straight. My office is right there.
Okay.
Straight up.
Thank you.
Not just good
classification.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
That.
I'm gonna go get one.
No.
It's great. I might go to
lab.
Wait,
this is all the
results.
Hey,
Ben and Jerry's
over there.
Yeah, I think
okay, fair enough.
And so.
Okay.